This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An ending oil spill again this week in the Gulf of Mexico. Crisis averted for now in Europe. Conservatives take the helm in the UK and a Supreme Court nomination in Washington. As the oil gushed on, oil execs were grilled. Here's New York Congressman Elliot Engel.
I just don't know how we could ever believe anything that we hear from the oil industry.
Conservative Party leader David Cameron became Britain's new prime minister.
We are announcing a new politics. A new politics where the national interest is more important than the party interest.
And President Obama nominated Elena Kagan for the Supreme Court.
And I thank you again, Mr. President, for this honor of a lifetime.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Your word on the oil spill, Europe's big wobble, Elena Kagan. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. It's always great to be here.
Also from Washington, NPR's Tom Jelton. He's just back from covering the big debt crisis in Europe. Tom, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and Tom.
Tom Jelton, you're just off the boat back from Europe or off the plane. How are they doing back there? Are they getting it together or not?
You know, the cliche is that Europe dodged a bullet, Tom, and I think that's obviously true. The, you know, huge trillion-dollar rescue package that was negotiated under great pressure last weekend was enough to reassure the markets a little bit in the short run. And we did see the euro currency recover somewhat afterward, but now it's started to slide back down again, and for very good reason, which is that a lot of the deeper issues remain unresolved. This was, there are a lot of questions that have not been answered. There are a lot of problems with this bailout. So for the moment, the euro has stabilized, and the stabilization of the European currency was the immediate goal. So you could say that that's been successful, but long-term issues remain.
Stabilized, but at an 18-month low at this point. Karen Tumulty, we're interested in how that whole European crisis and trillion-dollar rescue is playing out in Washington. It comes into the spending and debt debate here. Paul Krugman writing in the New York Times today, we're not Greece. Our economy's growing. It's not like theirs. But how's it playing out politically on this side of the Atlantic, Karen?
Well, of course, whenever you hear the word bailout in Washington these days, it, of course, has a certain political currency. There are a number of people, Republicans, a lot of conservatives, who are saying that essentially this is a prelude to what could happen in this country.
Jack Beatty, Paul Krugman's pushing straight back at that, saying this is going to be used as a crowbar to take apart the welfare state as we know it in this country, and we're not the same. What do you think, Jack?
Well, I'm looking at the Financial Times. They're talking about Europe entering a new era of austerity, belt tightening, cuts in social spending. And if that's the preview of things to come in America, then Paul is right. I guess the question is whether there is any alternative. To me, one of the, and I'd be interested in Tom Jelton's response to this, one of the striking features of this crisis is the almost political default that characterized it. That is to say, the German chancellor was reluctant right up until the end to act decisively on this bailout. The reason being she wanted to get over an election that was held last weekend. Her party, in fact, lost the election. And she didn't want to make a final decision until that was over. And the result was that the bond market kept, essentially putting a run on the euro, went beyond Greece, the crisis of confidence. And, of course, what's frightening is that something like that could very well happen here, a political default. That is, a belief that the United States will not pay its obligations. And that belief, it seems to me, could have a sound basis when you figure that any Republican who votes for a tax increase is dead. He will not win, or she will not win re-election. Second, no Republican now is apt to come out for cuts in Medicare, which is the only way to really talk about cutting the budget. That's because in the healthcare debate, they all made a huge issue out of Obama's cuts in Medicare. So you can easily see a situation in which a Republican filibuster prevents action on deficit reduction, sparking a crisis in the bond market, a kind of, if you will, political default.
There's a kind of maybe scenario. Tom, Karen, I'll come to you with that. Let's listen to Angela Merkel once she was sort of brought to the requirement that by the markets that she get on board with the $1 trillion rescue.
This package serves to strengthen and protect our common currency. It is unprecedented in the history of the euro and the European Union. We are protecting our currency in an extraordinary situation.
Tom Gelton, you've been watching in Europe very recently. What about the political dynamics here? I mean, they really took it to the edge, in part because Angela Merkel was watching this one regional election in her country. Could you see it jumping, paralyzing this country? If it comes here, do we respond to it or just sit and watch it roll in?
Well, Tom, Jack is absolutely right in focusing on the political dimension here, because this is one of the ways in which this economic crisis or financial crisis really differs from the one that we had 18 months ago, which was genuinely a banking crisis. This one is much more a political crisis because we know what has to be done in each of these countries. These are fiscal challenges. They have to do with reducing debt and deficits. And there is a way to do that. I mean, this is not, you know, sort of a mysterious thing where people disagree on how to face this challenge the way it was, in the fall of 2008. The question here is, do any of these governments, and that does include the United States, do any of these governments have the political will to do what clearly has to be done? Recall one thing, that the huge drop in the stock market on a week ago Thursday came as the TV pictures showed rioting in the streets of
Greece,
Athens. Yep. That was clear. What those pictures made clear is that the Greek government, regardless of what it said it was going to do, was going to face huge political challenges in pushing through the program that it needed to do. And we saw, again, of course, the same thing in Germany. We saw the election result in Great Britain has actually turned out to be encouraging with that little tape cut that you played at the beginning, which is, boy, that sort of goes against the polarization that we've seen.
It's not about the parties, it's about the nation.
Exactly. But still, what we saw in the election itself in Britain was a great deal of discontent and unrest on the part of the British people. So you put all these things together, and it really is a political challenge that I think it's really open to question whether any of these governments are going to be able to stand up to the political reality.
Karen, do you feel Washington, girding to deal with this? Maybe a little bit of that David Cameron reach across the aisle sensation there, or still just the old polarization and we go where we go?
Boy, I sure don't see a lot of reaching across the aisle on any of these issues. And, all of these worries and these worries about whether this bailout is going to work in Europe are juxtaposed against the, picture of the president Obama on Thursday going to Buffalo, pointing to signs of our own economic recovery and essentially turning to his critics and saying, I was right, you were wrong. And I think, this is it's just a moment of such extraordinary delicacy for our own economy.
I want to turn to the Supreme Court nomination and Elena Kagan there. Interesting reactions here. Plenty of support. The president's certainly very strong for her, but also from the right and from the left, some resistance. Let's listen first to Senate Minority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell, after he met with Elena Kagan yesterday. Polite before the cameras with her, but he's already had been critical. He's on ABC News here earlier in the week.
She's the least qualified in terms of judicial experience in 38 years. Now, some would argue that maybe we need to have people who who don't have judicial experience. I saw a survey indicating about 70% of the American people think that judicial experience is a good idea for somebody who's going to be on the Supreme Court. The second issue, the issue raised, was her advocacy, apparently, that Harvard Law School give up federal funding rather than comply with the Solomon Amendment, which was the law of the land.
Solomon Amendment on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There's the heart of the conservative critique. But on the other side, here's liberal blogger Glenn Greenwald on MSNBC saying he had concerns about different aspects of Elena Kagan's record.
Her belief in executive power, her praise for Bush Justice Department lawyers who sanctioned the illegal warrantless eavesdropping program, the utter lack of diversity of her hiring record at Harvard Law School. And these things need to be explored. But the real concern is she has purposely avoided expressing any opinion whatsoever over the last 20 years in a way that makes it impossible for any progressive in good faith to say that they support her nomination.
So, Karen Tumulty, what's coming in with Elena Kagan if and when she makes it through?
Well, I think that the concerns that you're hearing in both of these clips are sort of the low altitude concerns of the left and the right about Elena Kagan. The broader concern, I think, on the part of Republicans is that, you know, the fact that the president appointed his own solicitor general, his own chief, you know, advocate before the Supreme Court to the Supreme Court is essentially the phrase you kept hearing over and over again was a rubber stamp of his own policies on at the very moment when the court is going to be dealing with challenges to health care, potentially challenges to financial reform. And so, you know, I think that is the broader concern on the part of Republicans. And that is going to be one of the things they're going to be trying to sort of tease out at the hearings. On the part of liberals, Glenn Greenwald sort of hinted at it. But, you know, essentially, they feel like this is a missed opportunity, in his efforts to have a safe choice, the president missed a chance to put a real liberal force on the court.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the week in the news. Terror arrests, a Supreme Court pick, Europe's trillion-dollar rescue, and more oil than ever gushing in the Gulf of Mexico. Tom Gelton, NPR correspondent, just back from Europe, joins us from Washington, as does Karen Tumulty, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here, and we've got lots of callers on the Gulf spill front. Let's go to one right here from Evansville, Indiana. Travis. Travis, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question. This kind of relates to the BP, but also on kind of new energy sources. With so many people now kind of distrusting the oil companies to police themselves and to properly build their equipment, can you see that also affecting other energy sources, specifically nuclear power? Do you see when someone attempts to build a nuclear power plant, they're going to keep coming back to BP and saying, well, they were incompetent when they built this rig. How do we know this company is going to be competent when they build a nuclear reactor?
Sort of a knock-on effect that might hit other sectors as well. Well, Karen Tumulty, how about it? How big is this disaster now looming in terms of forward-going American energy policy? Maybe nuclear, as Travis asks.
Well, I actually think the more direct impact we're going to see on energy policy is on offshore drilling itself. That, you know, this spill comes just weeks after the president had announced plans to open up a bunch of areas to offshore drilling that hadn't been before.
Mm-hmm.
That's been put on hold. Governor Schwarzenegger's plans for some modest expansion on the West Coast has also been put on hold. So, you know, how this affects nuclear power development, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can also see maybe nuclear power advocates making an argument that, you know, comparatively speaking, it's not as unsafe as drilling.
And so maybe the argument that we need it, but certainly the sense of what infallibility, which the president suggested not long ago, was on big trial this week. Here's a little bit of tape from one of the days of testimony. There's BP America President Lamar McKay testifying before the House. This is on Wednesday. Tried to say that BP was doing its best down in the Gulf with the help from the EPA and the Coast Guard, using the best technologies out there for the cleanup effort to stop the gusher. But he faced a lot of skepticism. Here's California Democratic Lois Capps, first the BP president.
This is the largest effort that's ever been put together. So We believe we're using the best technology. If we have any other ideas...
But you never had any until it happened.
Well, we've been drilling with the Coast Guard for years, and so...
Did you develop technologies for dealing with this?
Not individual technologies for this, no.
I rest my case.
She rests her case. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but the oil is still coming, and coming here is the Oregon Senator Ron Wyden on BP's record.
This sure fits, in my view, a pattern of serious safety and environmental problems at BP. And the company always says the same thing after one of these accidents. We're going to toughen up our standards. We're going to improve management. We're going to deal with risk. And then another such accident takes place.
Great big one right now, much bigger already than Exxon Valdez, if the oil is coming as much faster than we were originally told. Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Bill, you're on the air, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. On the flow, I'm glad to hear that they're saying that it's bigger. When I first saw the video from the bottom of it coming out, I just kind of trying to guess at the amount and assuming that there's 31 gallons in a barrel of oil, it looked like that flow could easily fill a barrel every 2 or 3 seconds.
21-inch pipe and flowing like crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you just do the math real quick on that, and it's kind of hard to get a sense of scale down there in the flow, but, I mean, it easily looks like it could be every minute be 30 or 40 barrels, and you do the math out on that, and you quickly go 30,000, 40,000 barrels a day.
I've heard estimates up as high as 70,000. Just at the top of the hour, they were talking maybe 10 times the 5,000 that BP's been saying. Jack B., do you get the sense over the last days, a couple of weeks now since this began, of BP, you know, offering a kind of frank face, but behind that, some concealing going on? The video wasn't put out there. Maybe the initial description was that there was no problem really with the oil that was coming out, and then maybe a big underestimate here. It's an odd kind of back and forth, trying to look right in public, and yet what's really going on?
Yeah, yes, and the government seems to be involved in it. I mean, I read in today's Times, for example, that the figure of 5,000 barrels a day, which we now know to be grossly understated, was produced by government scientists in Seattle, and the government has stayed by that. Moreover, now I think that the Interior Secretary, Mr. Salazar, has to stand. It is in real trouble. We read now today in the Times that there was a letter from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration warning him in September that the Mineral Management Service in his department had been rubber stamping a series of requests in the Gulf that had no environmental impact statements attached to them at all.
Which they were required to have by federal law, I believe.
That's right. And in fact, since January, the Times points out, this is in the Obama administration, 3 huge leases have been approved, 103 seismic blasting projects, and 346 drilling plans, all in the Gulf area. And all presumably under the aegis of the MMS, which has rubber stamped them for industry, and the secretary was warned of this, if first by environmentalists in the spring when some of these decisions were made, and then by his own scientists or by the scientists from NOAA in September, and nothing was done. If that man holds on to his job, I think it'll be a very poor statement of accountability for this administration.
I'm reading here Kieran Suckling at the Center for Biological Diversity saying the MMS, the Minerals and Management Service, has given up any pretense of regulating the offshore industry. Of course, the premise articulated quite recently by the president himself was that we're beyond danger on this. There's a kind of uber safety at play. Rick in Orlando, Florida. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I'm wondering, with everything going on in the Gulf right now, what plans the major oil companies have for preventing something like this from happening again. It's just very ironic to me that there was so much talk here in Florida about offshore drilling and what's happening right now in the Gulf. And my question is, what can we do to prevent this from happening again?
Well, Karen Tumulty, one thing I think that's in the newly unveiled climate bill this week is some increased state powers for deciding whether they want this off their shores within 75 miles or something, Karen.
That's right. And, you know, I do think, though, there is going to be an even greater emphasis on technology here because, you know, the phrase fail-safe kept being used so often about what was out there in the Gulf, which seemed to have too much fail and not enough safe. And so I do think that the industry itself is going to have an incredibly strong interest both in paying for the damage of this and also in coming up with something that can reassure the public because their own future relies on it.
On the other hand, Tom Gelton, you wonder how the rest of the world looks at this. I just heard on the BBC before coming in today that China has just signed a new $20 billion deal with Nigeria to build huge refinery and facilities there. And, of course, a lot of that Nigerian drilling is in the water, offshore. I mean, the globally, the drilling goes on, Tom.
Well, that's right, Tom. And the reason for that is that that's where the oil is. You know, the easy barrels have long been taken out of the ground. You know, where the oil is now is offshore and in deep water. And whether it's off the coast of Nigeria or off the coast of Brazil or in the Gulf or in the future off the U.S. East Coast, you know, it's going to be deep water drilling. If you want to maintain that flow of oil for the global economy, go back to, you know, one of your earlier callers, Travis, talking about alternative energy. I mean, it's not solar or wind is not going to do it. You know, it's going to be nuclear. It's going to be coal. It's going to be natural gas. It's going to be oil. There are major environmental issues with each of these energy sources. And I think that there's going to be no way to avoid facing these environmental challenges in the years ahead, you know, unless you somehow manage to totally reduce your energy consumption on a global basis, which I think is pretty far-fetched.
We're going to be looking at that question in some depth in this hour on Monday. What would it mean to try and go without offshore drilling, given everything we're seeing out there? Let's look at the bigger economy here for a second and the tussle over interpretations. President Obama was out in Buffalo, New York this week, trying to promote his small business agenda, part of his Main Street tour, saying in this tape that the debate should not be over big government versus small government, but rather about creating growth.
I care about whether government's meeting its responsibilities to the people it represents. And I want to unleash the great power of our economy so Americans who are looking for work can find it. And I'm hopeful that our small business agenda doesn't fall victim to the same partisanship that we've seen over the last year. Helping businesses to create jobs should be something that both parties can agree to.
There's the president laying down his line this week. And, Karen, he was saying very explicitly to critics, look, we saved the economy. You sat on your hands. So, you know, back off.
Yeah, it's, you know, everybody you talk to about these midterm elections say that what's going to matter more than anything else as voters go to the polls in November is not even so much how many jobs there are, but sort of what they think the immediate future looks like. Do they feel like things are getting better? And, you know, so every first Friday of every month, I think the Democrats just sit there in terror as to what those jobs numbers are going to look like. Again, not so much for the absolute level of them, but just, again, something to create a sense of some kind of momentum that we're getting out of this thing.
Jack, what do you see on the economic front? The sense that people are buying the momentum? The sense that it's real?
I think that the sense that it is a U-shaped recovery is more and more clear. It's going to take a long while to work down through the joblessness to get people back to work. And there have been stories raising the question of just how many people will ever be coming back to work, that we may have not just a cyclical crisis. We certainly have that. We may have a structural one as well. That is to say, the conjoined forces of automation, de-skilling, and the offshoring of jobs Alan Binder, the economist, estimates that something like a fourth of current American jobs are in danger of being offshored. So the president's talking in terms of cycle, but beyond the cycle, people are beginning to say there may also be these structural issues where jobs are just not going to be what they were, say, in the 80s and 90s. And, of course, we just came through a six-year recovery that was effectively, in terms of keeping up with population, net jobless. Mm-hmm. Now, was that just an anomaly, or is that, in fact, a predictor of the jobs future? I don't know, but it really seems to me to be premature to be doing any sort of self-congratulation for this administration on job production.
Tom Gelton, what did you hear in Europe? Are they looking this way and hoping for the U.S. to emerge as an engine of recovery, or looking elsewhere, or scratching their heads?
Well, the big concern in Europe right now is, of course, their own economy. And the European market is important also for the United States.
Sure. I mean,
there are a lot of U.S. exports to Europe. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the, you know, we can take some pride in the strength of the U.S. dollar. But the stronger the U.S. dollar is relative to the euro, the less likely we're going to have U.S. exports to Europe. And in particular, if the European economy goes into a period of sluggish or near zero growth, which is where it's at now, that's very bad news for U.S. exporters. I mean, we are once again seeing the repercussions of having a globalized economy, and the idea that somehow the U.S. economy could grow rapidly and thrive while other economies around the world are not is just wishful thinking.
But that, as Don Rumsfeld might have said, is the economy we've got. Omaha, Nebraska. Chuck, you're on the air, Chuck.
Thanks for taking my call. Here's my comment. I think with all the fiscal concerns and the financial concerns, my concern is our country doesn't have any national resolve. We get split up into parties. We have the wealth in this country to fix our problems. And we just fight amongst ourselves because everybody looks at an angle to fix it. Can you imagine, like in World War II, if we today would say you got a coupon book and you can only buy these items, tires, whatever,
mm-hmm.
when we tell you, we'd never be able to do that. Rush Limbaugh would have it on his radio show. The AFL-CIO would be suing people. Yeah. We just don't have any national resolve to fix our problem.
Well, we say we'd never do that, but Greece probably said the same thing, and the markets are now forcing that. Spain and Portugal also adopting new austerity measures. Karen, tell me, what about it? You see Chuck's concerned about, will we bicker while it all goes down?
Oh, I think that's just a terrific point, because so many of our problems are long-term problems, which means they're going to take long-term solutions and a, you know, long-term willingness to stick with those solutions. But we do have a system that increasingly seems geared to the scoring of short-term political points. We've seen this new deficit commission has just gotten started up in Washington. It's supposed to be bipartisan. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to come up with some bipartisan recommendations. But, you know, to find a Republican willing to sit on it and head it, you know, they had to reach all the way back to Alan Simpson.
Right.
So who was a senator from Wyoming, long retired. So I do think that is one of the real problems with our political system as it stands today.
Tom, we've just got half a minute before the break, but do you see a new formula emerging in the UK? They've got Conservative Party in with the Prime Minister now, but with their, what's it called, the Liberal Democrats alongside, kind of the centrist. They got something new going there on the nonpartisan front?
The developments in Britain also almost make you wish that we had a parliamentary system here. You have a centrist, you know, here it seems the centrists are being drummed out of both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And in Britain, both major parties are trying to attract the center. I mean, you had first Labour and then you had the Tories both trying to win the support of the centrists, the Liberal Democrats. That's something that's almost inconceivable in the U.S. political scene right now.
I
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, protests and political violence in Thailand grew more intense. A perfect game was out there for Oakland A's pitcher.
Braden turns, he throws, and it's swung on a ground ball to short. Taken there, Pennington's got it. He throws, a perfect game! Dallas.
And more terror arrests and terror humor. Here's David Letterman.
Such a beautiful day in New York City today. The terrorists were using propane tanks for barbecue grills. Beautiful.
Bada boom. We're looking at a week in the news. Terror arrests, a Supreme Court pick, Europe's trillion-dollar rescue, and more oil than ever in the Gulf of Mexico. Karen Tumulty is with us from The Washington Post. NPR's Tom Gelton is here. Let's get Arthur from Henderson, Kentucky. Arthur, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to ask you guys, in watching the news and observing that there's not enough government officials riding herd or overseeing oil drilling or coal mining or food inspection, how is it that the Republicans get by with saying that government is too big? All these corporations and their corporate officers just engorge themselves with huge riches, and how is it that they can say that we don't need more government oversight? I do not understand.
It's a very practical question, Karen Tumulty. I mean, what we're seeing here in oil, regulations ignored, safety kind of handed over to the industry, and here's what we've got. Coal, it was not a dissimilar story. Arthur looks at food. We've seen that zone, and yet spending's way up there, and Republicans base a lot of their critique right there.
Yeah, you know, this question reminds me a little bit of the debate that we had right after 9/11 on whether or not the people who do the inspections at the airport, the TSA employees, ought mm-hmm. to be government employees. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there are some moments that make people sort of turn back to the idea that there are just some things that only government can do. I think at the same time, you know, we saw some of those same issues being raised with the Times Square bomber.
About what? About security? About policing?
Yeah, this is the point, you know, again, that people look at this, and as much as we argue over, you know, whether government should be involved in our health care or be, you know, taking over our banks or our automakers, there are a few functions that I think pretty much everybody can agree on, whatever their party, and we're every now and then reminded of this. And they often come up as these sort of public safety issues.
And yet the spending and government role debate goes on big time. We won't solve that one here today, but you mentioned the Times Square bombing plot. And, of course, there were arrests this week, some right in our backyard here, more in the Boston area, more in New Jersey. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder on the arrests made in Massachusetts and beyond.
These are people who are connected to Mr. Shahzad. We're still trying to determine exactly what the nature of that connection was. There's at least a basis to believe that one of the things that they did was to provide him with funds.
Arrests in Maine, Massachusetts, raids in New Jersey. Tom Gelton, are you watching this with interest from your sort of global perspective perch?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the interesting aspects of this story, to me at least, is that it has shown a spotlight on the, you know, Islamic financial system and this tradition of hawala, the way that money is transferred on a relatively non-formal basis, sort of avoiding some of the big institutions. You know, this goes a long way back, and I think one of the repercussions, one of the long-term consequences of this is that there's going to be a lot more attention paid, you know, in the world of terrorism financing, which is something that this administration, like the previous administration, has spent a lot of time trying to penetrate. I think that, you know, we're going to see now some new interest in some of these informal financial networks that may have been set up in recent years that could support ventures like this.
But Karen, I always wonder, I mean, there wasn't that much money necessarily that traded hands here. A couple of tanks of propane, an old SUV that cost, what, not very much on Craigslist. It's not as though they had to move tons and tons of money around to do this admittedly failed attempt.
Yeah, these arrests were very dramatic, but I still don't think that we have the information to quite know what to make of them and to what degree these people are, you know, the links between the bomber and the Taliban, which, of course, was one of the major questions that was raised. And also there are conflicting reports this morning as to whether their stories were consistent with his.
Jack, of course, we've got Faisal Shahzad, the alleged attempt bomber in Times Square, still kind of out of sight and reportedly talking and talking, but no day in court.
No day in court and talking. But you know, I'll just say disappointed to hear Attorney General Holder say on Sunday that, in fact, the administration was going to go to Congress to try to get some readjustment in Miranda, the Miranda procedures.
Being read your rights.
And this came out of the blue, since it appeared that this hadn't really been an issue with the Christmas Day bomber, hadn't really been an issue here. And it's part of this pattern of the Obama administration. You know, there was a phrase in the 19th century, dish the Whigs. This was a Tory phrase, meaning find out what the Whigs are doing and then do it. And you dish them. You essentially destroy them by taking their program. And again on this security front, the Obama administration is trying to dish the Republicans. The Republicans complain about Miranda. All right, we'll adjust Miranda. Earlier, in the campaign and certainly subsequently, the Republicans want drill, baby, drill. We'll drill, baby, drill. Again and again, there are these concessions in the terrorism and security and energy that almost make the Obama administration look like it doesn't really quite know what it's taking its signals from the opposition and validating the opposition's arguments. They dropped the death panels. Remember that? I mean, when there was the complaint about the death panels, instead of saying this is an absurdity, there are no death panels, they said, okay, we'll take the non-death panels out of the bill. And I think it just telegraphs weakness and lack of backbone in this administration that they're continually put on the ropes by the opposition.
Tom, I think what they would say in this case is they're just trying to stretch out that time before attorney when someone who's been arrested is willing to talk.
Well, there is something called a public safety exception in the Miranda law, which is essentially says that if there is some issue of immediate public safety hanging in the balance, that you don't have to immediately read a defendant his or her Miranda rights. And what Attorney General Holder and therefore the Obama administration is saying is that public safety exemption should be expanded to include possible upcoming acts of international terrorism. And, you know, Jack is correct in saying that they're sort of taking something out of the opposition playbook here. Charles Krauthammer, who's a pretty prominent conservative, had a column in the Washington Post this morning praising Holder for saying that he was interested in modifying this public safety exemption. And Krauthammer says that this is a new consensus in the national security establishment. So it is true that this administration has been shown itself to be more willing to sort of move in the direction, same direction the Bush administration was moving in before. And that is going to be alarming to people that, really take civil liberty protection very seriously.
Well, there you go. Who says we're polarized? Thomas in State College, Pennsylvania. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank
Hi.
You.
Yes.
The point and question I wanted to make is that with what recently happened in Times Square with the bombs in the SUV,
yes.
Do you think that it seems that the people that were trying to do this, they had no allegiance, they had no ties to a specific group in Pakistan. They weren't taking any orders from anyone. They were almost doing it on their own. So do you think that the lone bomber, the lone group who can do whatever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, is more dangerous than people who take orders from a certain group or have to do certain things in a certain way?
Thomas, we've got it, and let us pick it up. I have to say the word that's come out of Washington since that failed attempt is that, in fact, there were specific links and ties and time even in camps in Pakistan. There have been arrests there. And Karen Tumulty, that's what we're hearing is coming out from Faisal Shahzad's off-screen revelations to investigators.
Yeah, the initial presumption was that I think the phrase that somebody used was one-off, that this might have been just a lone actor. But, you know, increasingly it does look like there may in fact have been ties to the Taliban, which is something new because the Taliban was previously thought as being either unwilling or even incapable of striking outside the borders.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Ash. Ash, you're on the air.
Hi, I am just calling to actually, I want to disagree with your guest. I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but he was saying that President Obama and his administration they don't have a backbone because they have been offering concessions to, you know, the Republican ideas, which I think is false, because I think democracy is about listening to all sides, whether it is, you know, the one party, the Democratic Party, or the other one. And then coming up, you know, with results from both parties that sound good, you know, taking up good ideas from both parties. And I don't see that President Obama is doing anything wrong by, you know, saying that maybe drilling is not, you know, a very bad idea. In some areas now it is. It looks like it's not really a very good option after the spill, but, you know, at the time it sounded like a good idea.
Ash, we've got it. And Jack, I think that comes right to you. Ash says, what do you mean no backbone? This is what democracy is. If we hail it in the UK, maybe emerging with the new government there, how can we complain if President Obama exercises it here?
Yes, if the opposition's ideas correspond to things in reality. But in this Miranda case, this was a Republican talking point. It was, and they've been after Miranda throughout my life, as if this were some, you know, great weakness in the American judicial system, when no less than Chief Justice Rehnquist said this is part of the American system today. So I don't think it had any basis in reality that there was this big problem with reading people their rights. We didn't impede the matter in Detroit, didn't seem to impede this one. And yet there was this seeming concession to the talking point. And I think I don't believe that the death panels, there was no reality to it. And yet they said, we'll take it out of the bill. That's not bipartisanship. That's just cowardice. That's just capitulating to the other side's, talking points that don't have relations to reality.
I want to probe at realities on another front while we have time to do it. Afghan President Hamid Karzai was in Washington this week. Everybody trying to repair relations that have been very strained. The president and President Karzai and Obama came out and talked. Here's President Obama saying tension was part of doing a difficult job together, and both sides, he said, have their roles.
Our job is to be a good friend and to be frank with President Karzai in saying, here's where we think we've got to put more effort. President Karzai's job is to represent his country and insist that its sovereignty is properly respected.
And here's Afghan President Hamid Karzai in his makeup visit to Washington this week.
Definitely days have come in which we've had a difference of opinion. Indefinitely days in the future will come in which we have difference of opinion. But the relationship between the two governments and the two nations is strong.
Tom Jelton, there's a little question mark in President Karzai's enunciation of that last word. What about it? Is this relationship strong?
Well, if you were to ask me that question, if we were to consider that question a few months ago, given the barrage of criticism that was coming out of this administration directed against the Karzai government, you wouldn't think it was very strong.
A strategic liability. Yeah.
You know, you quoted Don Rumsfeld's famous line earlier in the program, Tom, where he said that you don't go to war with the army you want, you go to war with the army you have. And yep. I think what the Obama administration has concluded is you don't go to war with the ally you want, you go to war with the ally you have. And they have decided that, for better or worse, all that they've got to work with in Afghanistan is the Karzai administration, so might as well make the best of it.
And off they go. We'll see where that goes. Let's get a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to address the criticism of Elena Kagan regarding diversity in her faculty appointments.
Front page story in the Times today on that front. What do you know, Steve?
Well, I'm a retired staff member at the law school, and while I do have a lot of differences with Kagan's style of running the school, one thing she was known for, in fact, was not being an ideologue when appointing faculty members. So she actually appointed the best faculty members, regardless of whether they were on the right or the left, and ended up having a lot of diversity in terms of ideology and opinions and experience in her appointees. And I think she was known by that at the law school, by the faculty on the right and the faculty on the left.
Steve, our time is short. Let me go straight to it with Karen Tumulty. That's the record that Elena Kagan would like to put before the Senate in the confirmation hearings, Karen. Does it feel like it's working, like it's selling?
Well, I do think some concerns have been raised specifically among minority groups that they do have reservations about her record. But the caller goes to a second point about Kagan that is one of her main selling points in going to the court. Everyone agrees she's very bright, and they also portray her as a great consensus builder. Now, this is important as everyone, looks to figure out who can persuade Justice Kennedy on any given day.
Mm-hmm. You have to bring over that swing vote. I guess, Jack, there's not quite as much energy around this nomination because it doesn't really change the balance on the court. At least that's the conventional wisdom.
That's right. This is just keeps the same 5-4. It isn't the tipping point. That position isn't apt to be reached anytime soon, although you never know. I mean, things can change overnight on the court, subject as it is to the vagaries of life. But no, this doesn't, although you wouldn't know it from the Republicans. They're going to fight it every step. Although I see that Scott Brown made a good statement about Ms. Kagan, so that's encouraging.
We'll be watching. Karen Tumulty in Washington, national political reporter with The Washington Post. Thanks very much for being with us today, Karen.
Thanks, Tom.
Tom Gelton with NPR. Welcome back, Tom. Great to have you.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And Jack, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.